From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. A Thin Gentleman with Gloves by Simon West. At first glance, you would have thought Corbin Bellaman, an old duffer who had long ago run to seed. At second, you might have considered him a benign and harmless fellow who was somebody's grandfather. As a matter of fact, Bellaman was distinctly on the shady side. He was a crafty barrister in his late 50s who had for better than 20 years been the last resort of fences, petty thieves, murderers, embezzlers, and eccentrics like Alonzo Potter. Bellaman had done very well for himself in those 2 decades plus, but Alonzo Potter was his downfall. Not at all in the way one might suspect, however. He got along very well with Alonzo alive, but Alonzo dead was a different matter entirely. Alonzo Potter, almost alone among Bellaman's clients, was not a criminal. That is to say, he was not obviously one. The fact is, no one knew very much about him, except that he had once written a book with a great many people, had burned with a lot of public and private to do, since it was a book purporting to tell the secrets of black magic, necromancy, sorcery, and the like. At the time Bellaman first knew his client, Potter was already an old man, a wizened, stooped figure of a man who got around with the aid of a cane, and was never without a tall, gangling companion who walked a little behind him and to one side, like a mendicant, holding his head bowed and saying nothing. This might have occasioned considerable comment if Potter had gone out much, but he did not. He kept his out-of-the-way house in Soho, living quietly despite the queer stories that got around about strange happenings in his house, and eventually dying quietly, leaving Bellaman to execute his will, which revealed that there was a little matter of £50,000 to be bestowed upon Miss Clarice Tregardis, an old flame of Potter's. Despite his dealings with the underworld, Bellaman had never in his life seen £50,000 all in one lump, and the prospects of having so much money under his control was an exciting one. However, it was not until he had seen Miss Clarice Tregardis that any thought of appropriating the money entered his head. He had supposed that Miss Tregardis was most likely a chorus girl with a dubious past and a questionable present, but when she came to his office in response to his request, she turned out to be a pleasant old lady who was rather vague about the reason she had been sent for and remembered Potter as an unsuccessful suitor. "A nice boy, to be sure, Mr. Bellaman, and for a long time we were very dear friends. Very dear. But time and events, well, you know how it is, I'm sure, Mr. Bellaman." "Well, he's left you all his money, Miss Tregardis," said Bellaman. "Dear me, how surprising. But then he always used to do such queer things. Is it very much?" It was then that the idea of appropriating some of Potter's money for his own use occurred to Bellaman. He had been telling himself all along that he would charge a nice fat fee for acting as executor of the will. But now he realized that Miss Tregardis had no idea at all how much Potter might have left. And since she was obviously in poor circumstances, virtually any sum at all would be satisfactory. A chorus girl might have raised an immediate outcry and demanded to see the papers, but this old lady would be only too happy to leave it all in Bellman's hand and take whatever he cared to hand out to her. "The exact sum hasn't been computed as yet, Miss Tregardis," said Bellaman cautiously, "but when the tax to the crown has been deducted, I have no doubt it will leave you fairly comfortable for a while." That was putting it nicely, he thought. "Oh, really?" she said. "Then perhaps I could buy myself a few new dresses and a coat, and perhaps I can even have my apartment refurnished. Yes, perhaps I could.
I think you could, agreed Bellman. She might as well be assured of that much. It would not take a large percentage of the total sum left in his predatory hands. Would you care to retain legal representation, Mr. Gardis? Or are you content to leave the matter in my hands?
Oh, if Alonzo trusted you, I'm sure I can too, she said naively and departed.
Bellman had not expected it to be that easy.
He set about laying his plans at once. Of course, he did not intend to take any unnecessary chances. The old lady might, like as not, have some inquisitive relative who might poke his nose into the affair and demand a full accounting. So, to take care of any such contingency, Bellman determined to rig up dummy papers and a plausible account of doctored expenses in connection with the disposal of the money for anyone to see on demand. He toyed with the idea of just decamping with the entire sum, but then there would be the tax collectors for the crown, and besides, he was comfortable where he was, and there was no need of leaving his routine or his business,
which was drawn largely from Whitechapel, Limehouse, Soho, and Wapping along the Thames. More unsavory areas of London could hardly be imagined. His plans were laid with the care of an old master. He began by abstracting a modest sum, £1,000, with which to play the races. He did this with the idea that if he could make a goodly sum by so doing, he need not deduct as much as he had planned from Potter's hoard. Gambling was Bellamont's weakness. He might have been the owner of a comfortable nest egg if he had not insisted upon trying to double or triple every fee he took in, with the result that he was constantly living from hand to mouth. He lost £1,000. Moreover, he had a most disagreeable experience at the races. Just after he had placed his money, he fancied that someone tapped him on the shoulder, and turning around to look, he did not immediately see anyone he knew, but then saw, standing a little distance away, a tall, thin gentleman wearing a bowler hat, not unlike that Alonzo Potter had worn, and with a certain familiarity about him. He turned away, wondering where he could have seen him before, but in a flash he remembered. It was a silent companion who had always appeared with Potter, and who had vanished completely on the day that Potter was found dead. He looked back, but the fellow had gone. The disagreeable aspect of this trivial event lay not in the event itself, but in the uncomfortable twinge it gave to his vestigial conscience, particularly after he had lost the money. Before he dipped further into Potter's funds, he determined to conduct an inquiry into the identity of Potter's one-time companion, to discover for himself whether he might have any knowledge which could be brought to the attention of Clarice Tregardis. He worked at it for a week, utilizing every source of underworld information that was his. At the end of that time, he was not one whit better informed than he had been before. No one knew anything whatever about Potter's companion, save that he was never known to speak. No one had ever seen his face. The fellow habitually wore gloves. He was thin to emaciation, and he shuffled along after Potter more like a dog than a fellow human being. That he had disappeared completely after Potter's death, everyone was agreed. While the lack of information annoyed Bellman, nevertheless, the unanimous opinion about the fellow's disappearance was reassurance. He closed the incident by coming to the conclusion that he had mistaken someone else for the cadaverous companion of Alonzo Potter. After the lapse of a week, he tried the races once more, this time with £2,000, in that sublime confidence which always obsesses the gambler and leads him to believe that he can recoup previous losses as if by magic windfall, convincing him each time he ventures anew that his luck must turn by that mythical law of chance, and that this is the time. But this was not Bellamine's time. Far from it. He lost not only Potter's £2,000, but also 10 and 6 of his own. Moreover, all the way back to his office, he could not shake himself of the conviction that he was being followed. Naturally, being guilty of such peccadilloes, he imagined that the police might be keeping an eye on him and kept looking for anything resembling an officer. But of course, the ludicrousness of this presently impressed him, and his range of vision became more general. It was then that he saw the thin man, with his gangling arms
and his gloved fingers, shuffling along as unobtrusively as possible, half a block behind him. He stopped the first passerby to whom he came, caught him by the arm and said, "Pardon me, I've lost my glasses, and I've been expecting a friend." He's a tall, thin fellow, who shuffles along, wears gloves, holds his head down so that his face is practically invisible. I thought I heard him behind me, but I can't see well enough to be sure. Is there anyone fitting that description walking along behind me? After a moment of careful scrutiny, the passerby, looking askance at Bellarmine, as if the barrister had been drinking, assured him that there was no one even remotely answering that description in sight. His forehead beaded with cold perspiration. Bellarmine went directly to his office and took out Potter's will, thinking that perhaps he might have missed some reference to that mysterious companion in it, and hoping against hope that he would discover it without delay. He did. As for Simeon Brown, who has been my constant companion for several years, he shall be considered released from the bondage I have put upon him when the terms of this will shall have been carried out. That was all, nothing more. After he had read it a dozen times, Bellarmine was more mystified than ever. No matter how one looked at it, it did not make sense. What bondage? How could the dead potter exercise any choice in the matter of releasing Simeon Brown, the thin gentleman with gloves, who had manifested himself so curiously on these two occasions? No, the whole thing was fantastic. All except the thin gentleman with gloves, Simeon Brown. Bellarmine might have made a mistake the first time, but not the second. Bellarmine was no fool. Clearly there was more to this than met the eye. With a vague sense of uneasiness, the barrister laid his plans to go away for a while, the company of as much of Mr. Gardis's legacy as he could make away with. He paid the tax to the crown, made out a preposterous bill, and converted certain of his own securities into more cash, just in case he should take it into his head not to come back at all. Then he prepared, when the time was ripe, to send a check for £1,000 to Miss Tregardis, supremely confident that she would be completely satisfied with this amount in lieu of what, unknown to her, she had coming. However, he reasoned, before he did anything rash, there would be no harm in looking into the matter of Simeon Brown, since that last disturbing glimpse of him hurrying down the street in his wake, Bellarmine had seen nothing more of him. He did not connect with this fact the incident that he had kept his hands off Potter's money throughout this time. He pursued a careful inquiry, investigating Potter's papers to the last of them. He came upon a great many extremely strange references to subjects which Bellarmine thought properly belonged in the Middle Ages, when people still had a healthy respect and fear for witches, warlocks, and the like, and when spells and enchantments and potions were the order of the day. Curious how old recluses, male and female, seemed to go in for spiritualism, table rappings, Ouija, and the like. The late Mr. Potter's activities, however, did not come under any one of these heads. He had been a warlock. In his modest way, he had been a good warlock. He knew how to adapt even the most difficult of the old spells to his own uses, and he had left behind him a great many of these old spells, most of them in Latin, so that Bellarmine did not take the trouble to decipher them. However, it was among them that Bellarmine caught sight of the name of Simeon Brown, and after it, what appeared to be an address, 37-213 Upper Lishaway. At least, that is what it appeared to be. Bellarmine could not be sure. Her Potter's writing was spidery and small and not very certain. There was nothing else. And even this turned out to be a false lead, Bellarmine thought when he tracked down the address. For 213 Upper Leshaway was not a house address at all, but the number on the gatepost of a cemetery. Obviously Potter's script had been beyond Bellarmine. There was a Latterby Lane, and there was also a Leshley Street. It might have been one of those, but both were at such a distance from his office that Bellarmine was loath to go there. However, before taking his final drastic step, he made careful note of his findings, together with his supposition as to where he had made a mistake, and set out for a meeting with three of his old cronies, two of whom were medical men of a sort and had known the late Potter. With a directness singular for him, he told them about his experience with Simeon Brown. Peter Benfield, who was the oldest among them, opined that this might have been the same Brown with whom Potter had once had so much trouble. "No, Sim died years off," offered Pearson. Benfield smiled oddly and turned to Bellarmine. "You know, Bellarmine, you might be dealing with Potter's familiar." The others looked up at the theme, making sport of the barrister. There was no doubt of it, they averred, with many a wink and sly joke. Bellarmine was being hounded by Potter's familiar. Stung, Bellarmine suggested that someone might explain the meaning of the jest, which was amusing them at his expense. "Oh," said Benfield, "a familiar was just a halfpenny magic for an old wizard like Potter. A familiar was a companion summoned from outside somewhere to attend the wizard and obey his commands. A spell was put upon him by the wizard, if you went in for that sort of thing." "A ghost?" asked Bellarmine, with a poor attempt at concealing his ire at his companions. "Well, I don't think I'd call it a ghost exactly," conceded Benfield, "but then it might be that, or a skeleton, an imp, maybe even a corpse." He cackled mirthfully, much to Bellarmine's disgust, so that the barrister did not know whether Benfield was joking or not. "Wouldn't it have been just like old Potter," Benfield went on, "to command Simeon Brown?" "It certainly would." But Pearson, who had a literal mind, reflected again that poor Brown had passed on some years ago. Instead of clarifying the matter, it seemed that Bellarmine only got himself more perplexed. This was annoying to a man of his caliber, and it was inevitable that he should chuck the whole thing and go ahead with his plans. The attacks to the crown had been straightforward enough. The carefully doctored bill, preposterous as it was, Bellarmine put into his files for any curious person to see if any kind of investigation should follow in the wake of his absence from his usual haunts. Then he dispatched the check by the late post, and that evening he set out for Paddington to entrain for Aldershot, from whence he would cross the Channel and lose himself somewhere in France or Switzerland. Alas, for plans of mice and men. Bellarmine had scarcely stepped from the building which housed his office when he was conscious of someone walking along behind him. It was a dark night, and he was not at first listening, being busy with a reconsideration of his plans. Only when he had passed the street light did he become aware of the fact that the sounds coming along behind him were rather steadily mounting shuffling than orthodox footsteps. He looked back. It was a thin gentleman with gloves. A kind of panic seized Bellarmine. He did not for an instant believe anything of the conversation he had had with Benfield and Pearson, but there was undeniably something uncanny about the appearance of old Potter's companion at moments such as this. He felt frantically for the money, which he carried in a stout wallet in the inside pocket of his coat. It was safe, for it bulked large there and filled his questing hand. He increased his pace, his agile mind concerned now with some way of escape from Potter's companion. There was an alley which led out into a brightly lit street, where he might take the underground to the Praed Street station. It was a short cut, and by vanishing into its dark maw, Bellarmine's chance of outdistancing his pursuer was much greater. Accordingly, he slipped across the street, keeping to the shadows, and at the appropriate moment, he darted skillfully into the alley. If he had had the proper kind of imagination, he would have thought twice about doing what he did. His foresight, however, was limited, and when first he heard a shuffling sound behind him, he was only annoyed that the fellow had seen him enter the alley. Then he was conscious of the increased pace of his pursuer. Indeed, all within an instant, it seemed, the fellow was directly behind them. Could it be? He turned startled and looked back. Out of the alley's darkness came a pair of long, thin arms, reaching for him with gloved fingers, and behind it came an utterly horrible, soul-searing travesty of a face, whose eyeless sockets seemed to gleam with a hellish light, whose lipless mouth seemed to work in drooling ecstasy. Bellarmine did not have time even to scream. In the morning, Miss Clarice Tregardis received Mr. Bellarmine's check for £1,000. There was also in her mailbox a well-filled wallet, the contents of which, added to the check, made up the precise sum which Miss Tregardis was legally entitled to receive from Mr. Potter's £50,000 legacy, minus the tax to the crown. Bellarmine's disappearance was more than a 9-day wonder. The police ultimately got around to discovering that address he had written down and went out to investigate. Being possessed of far more imagination than the late Mr. Bellarmine, they proceeded at once to the Upper Leshaway Cemetery and went directly to Lot 37, which presumably had been meant. So it had. Lot 37 held the grave of one Simeon Brown. Moreover, there was every evidence that the grave had been recently disturbed. So an exhumation order was got, and the grave opened. The grave contained the body of Corbin Bellarmine, who had been strangled and otherwise badly mauled, together with the remains of the said Brown, badly decayed and partly skeletal, a tall, thin gentleman, apparently, whose bony, black-gloved fingers were curiously closed about Bellarmine's neck. It was a ghastly business, even for Scotland Yard. They issued a strongly worded statement in regard to the shocking vandalism accompanying the murder of the late Corbin Bellarmine, and hinted ominously that the entire mystery would soon be completely explained by the masterminds behind the walls of that sacrosanct sanctuary of mysteries. But of course, it never was.